Blog Talk Radio.
Marvin didn't try to be magic or charismatic and all that. He just was. Even when he sung the national anthem, I mean, it was Marvin Gaye. You know, it was just unique. It was special.
Can you see?
The man you're about to see and hear, should you be so foolish as to have just joined us, is Ray Charles.
Hello. All right. Three, four.
I got something, y'all, in my bones. Make me want to shout hallelujah. And I want to
sing along.
Lift every voice and sing, till I did heaven ring with the harmony. Oh, let us sing.
Let our rejoices rise high.
Loud as the orgia.
Full of the faith and the
doctrine
of
God. Oh, Lord.
Sing a song full of the
Partners in Community Building focuses on credit building, financial literacy, and home ownership for residents throughout Chicago and Illinois. All of our services are free. Call 312-328-0873 to get additional information on our homeownership counseling, rental assistance, Cook County foreclosure mediation, and small accessible repairs for seniors programs. PCIB is a HUD-certified nonprofit counseling agency committed to addressing the housing needs of all people. Call 312-328-0873 to schedule an appointment or visit us at www.pcibchicago.org.
For true inspiration, check out singer, songwriter, and radio personality Sylvia Fedrick. Sylvia, your sister under God's construction, brings to you her best in Christian contemporary gospel tunes, and they are available for download at www.sangsyl.com. That's SANGSYL.com. Or you can visit her profile at Chicago Black Business Network. For bookings, call Sassy Michelle at 512-914-4221.
Want to learn the secrets of the wealthy? Do you think that the wealthy sell their gold and silver, or do they buy gold and silver? Learn to create wealth, collect wealth, and preserve wealth for you and future generations. Find out how you can acquire free silver every month. Visit goldandsilverplan.com. That's goldandsilverplan.com. What you don't know can keep you struggling financially. What you know can change your life. Be in the know. Visit goldandsilverplan.com today.
Hey, you want more money in your pocket, right? Savers are losers, unless you save like the rich and beat inflation. The secret? Save the right kind of money. Pure, solid, 24-karat gold or silver for as little as 20 bucks a week, direct from the mint. Don't spend money. Exchange bad money for good money. Start today at SaveMetalMoney.com. That's SaveMetalMoney.com. The chains of slavery in the modern world are not forged with links of iron, but with the bonds of limiting ideas and debt.
Be in business for yourself, but not by yourself. Team up with a company voted the 57th most promising by Forbes. With no money to collect from your customers, no credit checks, and no cost for you to join. Visit electricmoneyteam.com, 773-980-9288. That's electricmoneyteam.com, 773-980-9288.
Hi there, I'm the X-Man, Xavier Paul. I'm a national network voiceover talent. You've heard my voice represent hundreds of brands and businesses for the past 15 years. Well, now it's your turn. I understand how important it is to promote your business or event in the right way. That starts with quality radio spot production and the nation's top voiceover talent. You might wonder, how do I get started? What's the best approach? What voice talent do I use? And most importantly, can I do it affordably? That's why I created CoolVoiceRadio.com. I take you to the finish line, giving you everything you need to advertise effectively on the radio. I'll help you create your concept, write your spot, even choose your music and cast your voice talent and get it aired on the radio. Now that's cool. Email me today at info@coolvoiceradio.com or call 646-326-7800 because nothing beats the right sound.
The Jimmy Lee Radio Network is now on the air. What's going on, everybody? It's Tuesday, and here in Chicago, we have an election for the second congressional seat. Now, they were projecting about 25% turnout, and that's low. I know the candidates were hoping for 25% turnout. We got slushy snow, icy weather, crazy conditions. Now it's about who can get the vote out. Who can get their base out so they can get their numbers up? Like I said earlier on this network, that it's going to be about 5,000 to 6,000 votes for the person to win. Might be upset. Who knows? But today is Talk to Me Tuesday. And I'm going to do a little something different. We were supposed to have Kiki Hurt, Dr. Hurt, on the show, but she's not going to be in. So we're going to have a long extended version of the George Washington Carver bio. And I'm going to read letters and emails and play back calls that was left for yesterday's show. A lot of people enjoyed the conversation with Miss Wilkes, Miss Hadia Pendleton's aunt. And I'm going to play that speech for those who wanted to hear it again. And a lot of you all who left raunchy emails about Jesse and a lot of raunchy calls, I'm going to try to get to them. I wonder who's going to come out victorious. The polls closed about an hour ago, and they're counting the votes. It shouldn't be that much to count, you know, seeing how so many of the people are not voting. So what I'm going to do is, since everybody loved the tribute that I did to Jesse yesterday, I'm going to set the mold. And then I'm going to read the letters and play the callbacks. If you didn't listen to us yesterday, this is what you missed.
A dramatic turn in the wheel of fortune for former Congressman Jesse Jackson Jr., pleading guilty to lavish abuse of campaign money and offering a tearful apology to his famous father. Here's ABC Senior Justice Correspondent Pierre Thomas.
Today, Congressman Jesse Jackson Jr. left court in disgrace, breaking months of silence.
It's not a proud day. I'm sorry I let everybody down.
The son of an iconic civil rights leader and one-time presidential candidate had been a rising star, even speaking at the 2008 Democratic National Convention. But today, Jackson was in court weeping as a convicted felon. He turned to his father to say, "I'm sorry." Jackson admitted to stealing $750,000 in campaign funds for personal gain. Memorabilia from Michael Jackson, Jimi Hendrix, and Bruce Lee. Furs, home furnishings, a Rolex watch worth $43,000.
Jackson now faces more than 4 years in prison as part of his guilty plea and likely will serve time.
Not a future Jackson or his father ever expected. Pierre Thomas, ABC News, Washington.
Jesse,
you're looking at the most hated man in U.S. politics. A man who stole almost $1 million from his campaign and blew it on, well, really cool stuff. Jesse Jackson Jr. And this video is about to get awesome.
We got Jesse Jackson Jr. in D.C.
Yes, it's the first time we've seen Jesse since he pled guilty to spending $750,000 of campaign funds on personal stuff, like
a fur cape,
multiple capes,
a mounted elk's head, a football signed by two American presidents,
$17,000 on cigars and other tobacco products.
Most importantly, a used Michael Jackson fedora.
In short, he's bad. Jesse Jackson Jr. And on the streets of D.C., our brave photog asked the questions everyone wants to know.
Why the Michael Jackson fedora and not the glove?
I mean, come on. That's great.
And that's not all.
Where is the Michael Jackson fedora now, Jesse? Jesse, are you going to keep the Michael Jackson fedora or the Bruce Lee memorabilia?
Apparently he bought a bunch of Bruce Lee memorabilia as well.
We love him. This is amazing.
Yep.
Did you at least get to wear the Michael Jackson fedora, Jesse?
And finally!
Have a good one, Jesse.
Oh, that was actually pleasant.
So what do you think about J3 now?
It's terrible, but he has made some epic choices in what he's bought.
It's stolen money.
Wait, where do you buy a fur cape?
Capes R Us?
Cape Town?
Okay. Cape Town.
Oh, that all sounds pretty cool.
You gotta love this a little bit harder.
Hate him.
Yeah, he's not a good guy.
But as far as
what he bought is fabulous.
So congrats, Jesse J. Jr. You're horrible, but you got style.
He got an Eddie Van Halen guitar.
It's been a bad year for former Representative Jesse Jackson Jr., and it doesn't look like it's going to get any better anytime soon. Jackson's been charged with counts of conspiracy, making false statements, and wire fraud in relation to a scheme to use over $60,000 of campaign funds to pay for personal expenses like a gold-plated Rolex, fur coats, children's furniture, and even Michael Jackson memorabilia. Seriously. Joining us now to discuss, we've got Joseph Urban Trout, HuffPost Chicago editor. Hey, Joseph.
Hi, how's it going?
Hi, Joseph.
Good to see you. So, hey. Joseph, what are the charges against Jesse Jackson Jr., and what are the details of this, plea bargain?
Well, first of all, it's $750,000.
Wow.
A lot of money. And this is dating back to 2006 here. So this is pretty huge, although it's been kind of coming down the pike for a little while. It's been rumored dating back to November since Jackson resigned from Congress, Jackson Jr., that is. And then his wife resigned last month from the city council where she served as alderman. And like you said, these are some pretty unusual purchases, at least for maybe you or I. I don't want to make any assumptions, but, you know, I'm not going out and buying $2,000 worth of Bruce Lee memorabilia repeatedly. But yeah, this is some crazy stuff now that we're seeing the specific list. And then I think it's here in Chicago, the kind of the biggest thing, seeing $750,000 itemized item by item, you know, with just all of this craziness.
It's not just Jackson Jr. His wife has also been involved in this, right?
That's correct. And she was his campaign manager. So she was sort of implicitly involved that way. But she's being hit with one count of false tax returns here. She faces up to 3 years in prison and a fine of up to $100,000. Then Jesse Jackson Jr. faces up to 5 years and a fine of up to $250,000 plus repaying this money. So it's really devastating, I think, to the Jackson family. You have Reverend Jesse Jackson. His father said today that this is really a difficult and painful ordeal. So this is just kind of, this has been coming down the pike for a few months, but this is really huge today that we're seeing this list that really just puts it all into perspective.
Can you give us a few more details, too, about the list? I mean, you know,
yeah.
we're giggling about it a little bit, too, but I mean, just how superfluous some of this stuff seems.
I mean, so you have the memorabilia, you've got all this Michael Jackson stuff, you've got an Eddie Van Halen guitar, you've got a Malcolm X, some memorabilia there. We don't know exactly what the memorabilia is. It's not that detailed. You got some Michael Jackson stuff. Then you've got these capes. You've got a mink reversible parka that went for $1,200. You have a black and red cashmere cape, we've got a mink cashmere cap for $800. I mean, you got a football signed by American presidents, so it's $5,000. I mean, this is some unusual stuff, but I think, he was under medical leave for several months with bipolar disorder and has struggled with some of those issues. And I kind of wonder maybe these purchases are being made because there was some mental illness going on, but just sort of trying to replace that void or deal with issues or problems in other ways. Trying to replace with material possessions. I mean, I think that's something all of us can relate to some degree, but to this degree, it's explosive.
Let me just ask you quickly about the filing today. You can see on my computer that it's called an information. You see it at the bottom of the screen there. An information, my understanding is, typically indicates this might be a guilty plea. Is that what you're hearing too?
That's correct, and that's what the reports have been here. A couple of weeks ago, we heard, you know, there have been sources talking about this for weeks and months now. No one knows who those unnamed sources have been, but now it's all kind of coming into light that, you know, they're saying they will be pleading guilty, and that's part of a deal to have a lesser sentence, hopefully. But who knows? It's in the hands of a judge now. And there is a sadness here that, you know, not only is it the Jackson family and the family name that's on the line here, but also their children. And so if, in theory, both of them were to go to prison, this really just pulls a family into pieces.
All right, Joseph, I appreciate you joining us. Thanks for taking the time, and we'll certainly check back soon for updates.
Thanks, Joseph.
Bye, guys.
All the best. All right, to all of you, thanks for watching our top stories. We'll be back very shortly with lots more on HuffPost Live on this Friday.
Yeah, that is what you missed if you didn't listen to me yesterday. A little flashback of what the media is saying or thinking about Junior. But that's not half of it. I got a caller the other day. I'm going to play his rant. I'm going to take a break in a second. William Kraft from San Diego, California. I'm going to run that Hadiya speech back. Also to you, Tammy in Pensacola. But yo. We know I got an election today. Not me. Here in Illinois. The 2nd Congressional District, Junior old seat. You know. And so this next song I'm about to play is dedicated to you, Junior, and to the Democratic nominee who might win it, because I don't know what the Republicans are going to do. Even the Republican committee men out there, Kankakee, is rolling with the Democrat. But to those Democrats and Jesse Jackson, watch out for the Martin Luther King Republicans. Because y'all ain't done.
We are amazed, but not amused. The
like I was saying, y'all ain't did nothing. Here in Chicago, we are the most uninformed constituents in Black America. You got people complaining about the health care bill. You got people not knowing what's going on in Mali, Egypt, Africa, all those places. But I'm going to come back with some more letters and some more you calls that I recorded and play. You left it on the minute. You left the recording there. So I'm gonna play it. So I guess you wanted to be on the air. Be back in a minute, everybody. Jimmy's Underground Radio. I'm just reading letters, answering emails, and doing a tribute to the world's greatest angel, inventor, Black man of the 20th century and the 19th century, George Washington Carver.
And now, the mellow sounds of Jimmy Irving.
Never meant to make you cry. You were the only one I've ever loved in my life. And so it's hard for me to show it. I've got to let you know it. 'Cause darling, I love you more each day. But the word got in my
can't do it no more. I can't sing no more sad songs. One, two, three, hit me. Bop, bop, bop it out of bebop. Bop, bop. Yeah, bass man. Come on up. One, two, three, hit me. Sound good. Yeah. Saxophone on the floor. One, two, three.
Pensacola, you can find that speech. Well, she did two speeches, but the one that I played on her Dear Pendleton, you can probably go to YouTube and type in Hadia's funeral, Linda Wilkes, and you'll find it. But here, check this out. Check this call out. It's a call from a guy, Junkyard Dog, that he wants to be known by. Left us on my machine.
Hello and welcome to Common Sense TV. I'm your host, the Doctor of Common Sense and the Junkyard Dog. They have indicted Jesse Jackson Jr. and his wife, and it is a tragic day in America. I mean tragic. This is a tragedy. Now, I don't understand why Jesse Jr. has to go to jail, because it's not his fault that the money was calling his name. I mean, the boy went to sleep, and when he went to sleep, the money woke him up and said, Jesse, rise and spend me. It wasn't his fault. I mean, if you ask his daddy, he'll tell you it wasn't Jesse's fault. Jesse Jackson Sr., could you explain to the folks what really happened? Well, it's not Jesse's fault. Let me tell you, it's the white man making Jesse take the money. They put the money in front of Jesse. Jesse had to take the money. The money called his name at night. The money called his name when he traveled. The money made his mistress need that watch and other things. It's not Jesse's fault. I think we should sue the white man for making Jesse take the money. That's what we should do. Can I get an amen? I'm sick of the oppression and suppression and rejection and subjection of the black man. Jesse is innocent. I'm telling you, the white man is to blame for putting the money in Jesse's hand. They knew he was bipolar. If he is bipolar, he very well can't be blamed for this. It's not his fault. White man need to stop oppressing the colored. We're still at the back of the bus. Jesse Jr. needs to get off because the white man put the money in front of him. Thank you, Jesse Jackson Sr. See, that's the mentality of the liberal mindset, especially Jesse Jackson. See, personally, I think it's the money's fault. Because Jesse Jackson Jr., the money should have known that he was going to steal it. You know, just like the gun caused people to shoot innocent people, we ban guns, we should ban money. That's the problem. If we had banned money, Jesse Jackson Jr. would never be in trouble if we just banned the money. No more money in America, damn it. Let's get money control. We start banning the money, we don't have to worry about the black man being oppressed by these white folks trying to force them to steal money. Now, let's ban money. I'm on a crusade. I'm going to get all the Hollywood actors and actresses to go on a crusade and make videos about how money is bad. We should ban it because it's causing people of color to steal the money. Now, we know they're not the only one. As a matter of fact, it's some white people that just stole some money, too. So I think, on that note, Jesse Jackson Jr. shouldn't have to go to jail because some white people got off, too. This is the logic I want to use to defend my client, Jesse Jackson Jr. His wife put a lot of pressure on him to keep up with the Joneses. And in order to keep up with the Joneses, he had to steal the money. How you think he's going to get his house redecorated if he don't steal the money? Now, you people are being unreasonable. As a matter of fact, he should get a bonus because he only sold $750,000. Now, that technically makes him a rich guy because Barack Obama said anybody making $250,000 or more was rich. So we're not going to get him on tax evasion and stealing the money. We're going to get him for being too damn rich. You need to be taxed, son, because you were stealing too much money and made yourself rich. And you know we are at war with the rich. Now, why aren't the media not saying anything about this rich, spoiled brat who was born with a silver spoon in his mouth. You know Jesse Jr. would not have been elected if it wasn't for his daddy. Now, come on now. This is nepotism. Now, Jesse was born with a silver spoon in his mouth. He's a rich, spoiled kid. Want the media to say this. He stole the money because he's spoiled and rich. His daddy had been ripping off. You know his dad is a professional pimp. And he's been pimping, getting money for years. And then he, matter of fact, why did Jesse Jackson Sr. ever go to jail for any? I know that boy's got to have been done something to be stealing or something. It ain't fair for Jesse Jr. to go to jail and Jesse Sr. gets to stay out. As a matter of fact, let's make Jesse Sr. the sacrificial lamb for Jesse Jr. Come on, Jesse. You need to at least go to jail for your son. Take the sins of your son upon you, my brother. Jesse Jackson Sr., would you be the sacrificial lamb for you?
Well, you know, I would be the sacrificial lamb, but it's not Jesse Jr.'s fault. It's the white man's fault, so therefore I can't be the sacrificial lamb. I'm not going to do it. I'm not going to let you suppress, oppress, depress, or depress me. Not going to happen. You may as well get another sacrificial lamb. How about let's get a white man to be the sacrificial lamb for Jesse Jr.? That sounds like a winner to me. Can I get a amen? That's what I think the problem is. The white man made Jesse steal the money. Now let him off. Matter of fact, give him a couple of $1 million.
Yeah, Mr. Junkyard Dog. I'll be on the Jacksons, but I don't do it out of anger. You know, it ain't personal. My shit is business. He know what he did. He know what he said. You know. But like, quote unquote, Aunt Hattie Jr., like Aunt Hattie said, Jr., you dig one hole for someone, you dig it for yourself. But I'm going to leave it alone like that. But cause I'm not doing it out of anger. Like my girl Linda Wilkes said, we got to let the darkness go that's inside of us so we can start flourishing and showing this light out. Okay, this is speech that she did that people said they want to hear again. You can find it on YouTube under Hadea Pendleton's funeral. It's a speech by Linda Wilkes, the light bearer.
I am Hadea's aunt, and I love Hadea. What was inside of Hadea that connected her with individuals who had never met her? Some saw her picture, some saw her beautiful smile, others simply heard her name. Yet they were deeply moved and touched by Hadea. What drawing power did she embody? It was her inner light radiating outward and connecting with humanity's inner light. Light has power and is a potent force. It has been demonstrated by the outpouring of love from people across the globe. Hadea's light has touched individuals, mothers, fathers, families, groups, organizations, as well as governments across this planet. If this does not demonstrate the power of light and love, then we are a people who are deeply cloaked in darkness. If we have not sensed that we have been touched by something other than the physicality, then we are a civilization that has profoundly disconnected from our God, our Creator. Hadea's inner light shined forth, touched, and caused mankind to feel an inner awakening and a sense of love. Love for a 15-year-old girl that most had never seen, but has deeply felt her. Ask yourselves the question, why do I feel like this for this little girl? What is it about her that begs that we pay attention? It is the inner light of spirit that emanates from Hadea. It radiates outward to humanity, firmly conveying the idea that it is time for us to hear the call and seek our very own inner light. The environment is ripe for change, but the winds of time will weaken its usefulness and it will lose its value. We cannot allow darkness to prevail. We must be the light. Be it a flicker, dimly lit, or a blazing flame, it must be ignited collectively to be effective. If we look within with a deep knowing that we have an inner light, it will be fueled by our Creator until it becomes a full force, a powerful light. Hadea's light has proven to be potent. We are ready as a people to connect with her light and pour it forth until it's. We are ready as a people to connect with her light and pour it forth until its brilliance transmutes all darkness. The light has been dim across this globe. Therefore, the darkness of violence and hatred has been allowed to prevail. The evil of darkness has no form and no real order. Darkness only is. Light can pursue darkness. Darkness cannot pursue light. Light can be any direction. It can diffuse the very essence of darkness. Then darkness, comprised of many fears, will retreat. It must flee. Love and light, dispersed of many fears, will retreat. It must flee. Love and light disperses darkness. What did mankind do before fire was discovered? He used his own inner light. Light should never worry about darkness. Darkness should worry about light. We must rediscover our own inner light because it is potent. It is clothed, planted with grace with her beauty. she fed her in the light until it became so brilliant that it touched the heart of this planet. 15-year-old idea has led the way. She has lit the path for us. Traveling this path, we may not be able to take a quantum leap. Maybe we can only baby step our way, yet we must move forward. It starts right here in me, and it starts in you. We all have carried our darkness, but we must allow the light. As Hydea has illuminated the path, we see, we feel, we have a deep knowing that we must act now. We must walk this path together while Hydea's light is still in full force. Darkness cannot exist where light is. Darkness must show itself that light may disperse it. If darkness is not seen, then how shall it be diffused? We must look at darkness with no fear, even our own very personal darkness. We must acknowledge it so that we may shine our own inner light upon it. Darkness must be confronted now. Hydea lovingly talked about her circle of friends, comprised of children of different races and cultures. Rest assured, people, that she has carried this very ideal onward. I have a deep feeling that Hydea, the light bearer, is holding the light as well as the hands of the children who have succumbed to violence across Chicago, from the West Coast to the East Coast, from Columbine to Connecticut, and all the children across this planet who have perished at the hands of violence. They are a collective moving upward and forward, all carrying the light, illuminating the path before us. Hydea's light is a powerful force that energizes the wind beneath her wings. As she takes flight, let not her ascension be void of action. Let us blaze forth the full force of our light, marching behind the young light bearers, such as Hydea the light.
Hydea the Light Bearer by Miss Linda Wilkes. And to the Dawn of the Dead in the chat room, he said, 244 people died in January in Chicago, a city of 2 million. 44 people died in Detroit in January, a city of 600,000. We are all Hydea, the light bearer. We'll be back with our tribute to George Washington Carver.
Are you the parent of a troubled teen, or you just want to have a closer relationship with your child? If so, sign up for our free webinar called 5 Easy Tips to Effective Communication with Your Teen right now, hosted by teen expert Release Henry. Log on to successfulteenparenting.com/webinar.
Walking down the street now is a dangerous thing. There are drug dealers, crack houses, gang members, and crackheads. People fighting, cursing, and killing too. So much chaos, we don't know what to do. But if people only knew that they are hurting little children, if they could only see what our community could be. When in consultation, 1, stay calm. 2, try to say something positive. 3, tell the person what's on your mind. 4, ask if the person understands. 5, thank the person for listening if you can. Come on, y'all, let's be an example. It has to start somewhere. How about now? For more information on ways to prevent violent crimes, contact Totally Positive Productions at 773-488-9553.
Even superheroes gotta be healthy. Get the Sister Girl Workout Book, a graphic novel available this Black History Month at the DuSable Museum Trading Post gift shop located at 56 and Cottage Grove in Chicago. There you'll find our growing line of hot black age graphic novels, or visit Only Studios at www.onlistudios.com. Plus, get your own Onlywears Art Star Denim Jacket. These one-of-a-kind special designs are available now at the Elephant Room Gallery at 703 South Wabash in Chicago. Only's wearable art brings out the art star in you. Indie today, Black Age forever at www.onlistudios.com.
Tired, stressed out, or just need me or we time? Then Phoenix Risen, Baltimore's exclusive bed and breakfast, is the place for you. Phoenix Risen offers an unforgettable, rejuvenating experience with exquisite guest rooms. Find peace and calm in the Sedona Room or Haitian Room, or relax in front of a marble fireplace in the Serengeti Room. Call 410-462-2692 today to schedule your escape to Phoenix Risen. Visit us online at phoenixrisen.com.
Jimmy Lee Tillman tribute to George Washington Carver.
The course of Southern agriculture. He turned soybeans into plastic and carved his place in history. An orphan slave set free with a microscope and a vision. Now, George Washington Carver Tech on Modern Marvels. What do biodiesel fuel and peanut butter have in common? How are crayons and space travel connected? What are soybeans doing in our automobiles? These marvels can all be traced back to the inventive mind of a man who was born a slave, but emerged a master of scientific discovery.
He was able to just look around him and see the raw materials and then see the human need that was out there and bring the two together. And so my own personal view of Carver is that he was a master integrator.
Carver had the most remarkable heart. And that's the thing I think I love the most about his life. I mean, as tremendous of a scientist as he was, he coming out with so many useful products that even today, I don't even know what we would do without, his heart was the best.
Dr. George Washington Carver is well known throughout the world for his revolutionary research, particularly with a peanut. In the early 1900s, he discovered and developed more than 300 new uses for the legume in food products and industrial applications, from face cream to a cure for dandruff, from linoleum flooring to motor oil. Carver saw infinite possibilities in the peanut plant.
He literally inspired other researchers all across this country to take a deeper look at this plant. And of course, I believe that the end of the line has not been reached on what he uncovered.
But Carver's legacy goes far beyond his accomplishments with what was called at the time the lowly goober. He toiled for more than 40 years in his laboratory at Tuskegee Institute in Alabama, and is credited with countless breakthroughs in agricultural research.
The impact of that was just astonishing. Carver, through the kind of research he did, was able to really lead the revitalization, really, of a whole region, the southern region.
He really is one of the great American heroes. If there's anyone you're going to learn about, you should learn about, you know, Carver would be one of those people.
George Carver was born into slavery in 1864 in Diamond Grove, Missouri. He was the property of Moses Carver. Towards the end of the Civil War, Southern bushwhackers raided the Carver's farm and kidnapped baby George and his mother.
Moses Carver hired a Union scout named John Bentley to trace after them and try to recover his property. Bentley was able to find baby George, and the mother Mary was never seen again. We do not know what happened.
George was near death when he was found. Moses and his wife took care of him like he was their own child. Too frail to work in the fields, he helped out with the household chores.
It was on this farm that he had spare time to go out and wander in the woods and enjoy nature and become very close to nature. He would look at a briar, he would look at the soil, he would look at the different leaf patterns and question and wonder and ask, why? Why are things like this?
George was inspired to paint after visiting a neighbor's home and seeing works of art for the first time.
So he came back, created his own brushes with twigs, and he would take nature's berries and grasses and create colors, an array of colors, and begin to paint.
Young George Carver's inventiveness and hunger for learning compelled him to seek what was impossible for many African Americans of his day: a formal education. Around the age of 11, he left the Carver farm and walked 10 miles to Neosho, Missouri.
determined to attend classes at the Lincoln School for Negro Children. He worked for his room and board at the home of Mariah and Andrew Watkins, who lived next door to the school.
The story is that at lunch hour, he would jump the fence between the school and Aunt Mariah's house and go over and help her with her laundry.
Many years later, George was inspired to draw this picture of the school and the Watkins house. George studied hard and got his high school diploma. He applied to Highland College in Kansas and was accepted.
It was a big moment. Then he went to Highland and he showed up and they said, "We didn't know you were black," and they turned him away. It was a huge disappointment.
George didn't give up. In his mid-20s, he applied to Simpson College in Iowa, where blacks were allowed. He was accepted and began taking classes in painting.
His first love was art, and he had a teacher. His name was Etta Budd. She was very dubious about whether a black could make it in art. It was a near impossibility. And she was a little concerned about him being... He was not the first black at Simpson, but he was the only one at the time.
Carver's complex understanding of nature came through in his paintings and drawings at Simpson. Etta Budd noticed this talent and encouraged him to change his course of study to horticulture. Carver took her advice and transferred to the Iowa State College of Agriculture in Ames, where he became the first black student.
He had some trouble with dining room privileges and other things, but he overcame them by his knowledge, which was so conspicuously immense that you didn't have to be in his presence very long to realize that this man knew things.
When Carver completed his bachelor's degree, Iowa State officials offered him a teaching position. The first black student in the college's history was now its first African-American professor. Though Carver was content at Iowa State, in April 1896, he was offered an opportunity that would change his life forever. Booker T. Washington, a leader among the newly freed slave population in the South, invited him to come to Tuskegee Institute, an all-black college in Alabama.
When Booker T. became aware of Carver, that there was an agricultural expert in the country anywhere who was black, that was huge. He was really the only one in the whole country. Booker T. badly wanted someone like that.
At the age of 31, George Washington Carver had found his true calling. He went to Alabama with a mission to help a once enslaved population find its way to self-sufficiency. Little did he know what landmark discoveries lay ahead. One of George Washington Carver's closest friends at Iowa State was James Wilson, who would later become Secretary of Agriculture under President William McKinley. George Washington Carver Tech will return on Modern Marvel. Turn to George Washington Carver Tech on Modern Marvels. Today, 50,000 peanut farms thrive in the United States, most of them in the South. Virtually all of them have taken root in the past century, thanks to the horticulture professor who ventured to Tuskegee with a sense of mission in 1896. When George Washington Carver arrived by rail in Alabama, he saw no peanut fields. Instead, he was dismayed to see only one crop growing in the dry, sandy soil.
1794, Eli Whitney invented the cotton gin. And from that date on in to 1900, cotton was king.
Carver knew that a single crop system was not good for the soil.
Any time in agriculture you base your economy on one single crop, you're vulnerable. In a fertility standpoint, you're depleting the soil and maybe not returning all the nutrients there that is taken.
Carver also recognized that the only thing more vulnerable than the nutrient-deficient soil was the multitude of poor black sharecroppers working in the cotton fields from sunrise to
to sunset.
They were tied into the industrial system in the Northeast, where they had the mills, cotton mills, and it was a big system, and they were all captive in it.
Carver was anxious to get to work to solve the South's agricultural dilemma. But when he arrived at Tuskegee Institute, he discovered that he didn't even have a laboratory in which to work. And Tuskegee had no money to properly establish one.
So he went out into a local junkyard and found old pots and pans and spoons and took his students and said, "We are now collecting the implements for our laboratory." He was the absolute first person to bring science to Tuskegee University.
He was one of those great visionaries that, you know, when Booker T. Washington shows him this campus and there is no agricultural college, there's nothing, you know, he had the ability to take nothing and make it into something. And I think that, you know, his life was a great example of that.
Carver started reaching out to the farmers in the area, showing them how the cotton they grew year after year was sapping the nitrogen and other nutrients from the soil. He encouraged them to plant crops that would restore these important elements back into the land. Crops like sweet potatoes, cowpeas, soybeans, and peanuts.
He was another one who came here because he cared about the man furthest down. He cared about the poor. He cared about African-American people who were poor in the rural areas. And as such, he took his science to the people.
Carver designed and implemented what he called a movable school to educate the farmers about crop rotation. Many took his message to heart, but few acted on his advice.
The farmers agreed, but they did not immediately heed because they could not get loans at the bank for any crop except cotton.
Yeah, it was the cash crop at the time, and a lot of people, that was their source of income, and it would have been very difficult for those farmers, especially the poorer farmers, to change over from cotton to peanuts, and there was no market at the time for peanuts.
Carver's concern for southern agriculture wasn't restricted to how cotton was bankrupting the soil. Another threat was lurking menacingly on the horizon. The boll weevil, the dreaded insect that had already decimated the cotton crops in Texas, was making its way across the South.
And it was moving through Mississippi, Louisiana, and headed to Alabama and Georgia at the rate of about 100 miles per year. And he warned them.
There was no stopping this devastating force of nature. The weevil actually lays its eggs inside the unripe cotton boll, and the newborns eat their way out, destroying the crop in the process. Carver believed the South's best defense against the boll weevil was the peanut, but he had to convince southern farmers that peanuts could become the cash crop that King Cotton had been for so long.
George Washington Carver really became an evangelist for peanut growing in the southeast part of the United States.
In 1902, Carver entered his lab at Tuskegee to begin intense research into the peanut. He explored its properties and looked for ways to put the protein and vitamin-rich crop to use. Peanuts are made up of oils, resins, fats, sugars, and starches. And Carver came up with more than 300 new uses for them, in recipes and in a variety of synthetic applications.
And he made paper and ink and shoe polish and floor wax and axle grease. And he did have some kind of a peanut plastic that he'd made.
And all of these uses, 300 of them, all the way from various soups to soap and shaving cream. He built the foundation block upon which peanuts were ushered in.
As Carver predicted, in 1915, the boll weevil hit the southeastern farms and completely destroyed the cotton fields. None of the farmers from Georgia or Alabama could pay off the loans on their land. But thanks to Carver's zealous advocacy, peanuts were poised to become a viable commercial alternative to cotton.
By 1917, cotton was dethroned and peanuts was lifted up, and the acreage increased in the southeast 400% in just 2 years.
As peanut power spread across the South, Carver continued to experiment with a now lucrative crop. While analyzing the properties of peanut oil, he discovered that it was very easily absorbed when rubbed onto the skin. Carver promoted peanut oil as an effective lubricant to be used in vigorous massage treatments for those suffering from muscular disorders. Thousands of patients, including those crippled by polio, came to Tuskegee to receive peanut oil massages. Even more wrote to Carver to purchase the oil. While it was never considered a cure for any disease, those who underwent the treatment reported encouraging results. Word of Carver's promising work made it all the way to the White House.
One of the extractions that he did with the peanut, one of our presidents, Roosevelt, used it for his infantile paralysis.
In 1942, President Franklin Delano Roosevelt paid an official visit to Tuskegee. He greeted Carver in person and applauded the research being done on the Alabama campus.
I'm proud to come to Tuskegee because I'm proud of what Tuskegee has done.
While Carver has been called the father of the peanut industry, there is one product that many mistakenly attribute to him: peanut butter.
Peanut butter as we know it in America was basically invented in 1890 by a physician in Missouri. And he was looking for high-protein, nutritious foods to feed his patients who had trouble eating meat because they had poor dental health. The first real introduction to the masses for peanut butter happened in 1904. At the Universal Exposition in St. Louis, and that's when really peanut butter was introduced to the American public.
And then this complemented and augmented George Washington Carver's research at that time. The two are not unconnected because he had done laid the foundation, even though he didn't invent peanut butter. He had laid the foundation for raising up and digging deep into the kernel and chemically telling the world what a wonderful food product peanut was.
His love of peanuts helped to really promote its usage widespread. And I think that, you know, he would be very happy to see how his legacy has really taken shape in modern day America.
We basically take a peanut that George Washington Carver helped develop and build in the field and help it grow to what it is today. To the point that we now buy the peanut, we shell the peanut, and then we offer a service to customers who then further process it.
Carver would no doubt be pleased with the assembly line efficiency of modern peanut processing plants, like Golden Peanut in Dawson, Georgia.
We shell about 25 tons an hour of peanuts. It takes about a truckload an hour to supply this plant.
The peanuts that make the grade are bagged and sent to manufacturers. Those that don't measure up undergo a process that's come a long way since Carver's day.
Broken kernels, damaged kernels, small sizes are then sent to the crushing plant. There we process them for peanut oil and the balance being peanut meal.
When Carver produced peanut oil in his lab more than a century ago, he boiled 25 pounds at a time and then extracted the oil by straining the mixture through cheesecloth. Today, the refineries steam heat the nuts and then put them through a mechanical press to extract most of the oil. At Golden Peanut, they press 350 tons of peanuts each day. George Washington Carver's work with the peanut in the early 1900s became the foundation for a new science known as chemurgy, the process of discovering industrial uses for agricultural products. Using peanuts, sweet potatoes, soybeans, and other crops, he literally planted the seed for technological innovations that would change the course of farming in the United States. In 1921, Carver was invited to testify at a congressional hearing for a proposed tariff on peanuts. He was allotted 10 minutes, but congressmen were so impressed by Carver's testimony that he was allowed to speak for over an hour and a half. George Washington Carver Tech will return on Modern Marvels. We now return to George Washington Carver Tech on Modern Marvels. George Washington Carver's enduring influence is evident in a diverse array of products that modern consumers use every day. Carpet backing, crayons, oil solvents, and even a new vodka are some of the items that can be traced to his experiments with another soil-enriching and protein-rich crop, the soybean.
We work in plastics, adhesives, and lubricants, so it's really a whole realm of new products from that technology.
Carver learned that the oil from soybeans is composed of 5 fatty acids, and that the bean itself is naturally rich in vitamin E.
You have a bean that has a lot of oil in it and a lot of protein, and it can be crushed and separated, and things can happen to that little bean.
When Carver looked at the soybean under the microscope, he saw that the oil had chemical properties that would allow it to easily bond with other substances.
The soybean oil itself is really long-chained. It's a lot of carbons in a row, 13, 16 carbons. And so that gives it ability to be a very flexible type of oil to be used, and it's also relatively inexpensive as an oil.
Carver's early experiments resulted in food products. Soy mayonnaise was one of his first successes.
He said he started work with the soybean around 1903, and by the time they'd finished that phase of the work, they had about 30 products.
When I go in a supermarket and go along the shelf of health foods, and you see bacon and lunch meat and the mock chicken and all those products that are made out of soy and other vegetable-based products, you just have to think of Carver. I mean, that was a major focus for him.
In his humble lab at Tuskegee, George Washington Carver experimented with a handful of beans, a coffee grinder, and some beakers, and came up with more than 100 new uses for soybeans and soybean oil, including a type of soy plastic. In the 1930s, automotive pioneer Henry Ford became aware of Carver's pioneering research with soybeans. In 1937, he invited him to participate in a scientific conference in Dearborn, Michigan. Ford shared Carver's passion for developing new uses for farm products, and he was a major player in the Chemergy movement.
And he was really taken by the fact that Carver could take soybean, for example, and come up with components of car parts.
You look at a guy like Henry Ford, who had tremendous resources, and he was always looking for the newest and the brightest and looking for other opportunities. And he saw this man, Carver, and he saw him as just a gold mine, a wealth of information and a wealth of creativity, and really wanted to bring him into his organization. And Carver was not drawn by the money, not drawn by the opportunity. He knew that his job was to be there at Tuskegee, to teach, to guide.
Despite his devotion to Tuskegee, Carver continued to personally consult with Ford about his ongoing research in soy plastics. In 1942, the automaker unveiled a car that included a bushel of soy in its construction.
The gear shift knob, the door crank handles, the foot pedals, things like that. Mr. Ford had nearly 7,000 acres of soybeans grown right there in that area. He had the research labs right there that he worked in. And he tied that with industry in his plant of building automobiles.
In a rare film from 1943, the Ford Motor Company revealed a car that had some body parts constructed from soy plastic. Ford researchers wanted to demonstrate just how strong and ding-proof this material could be. And Henry Henry Ford himself even took a few whacks.
Henry Ford took a mallet and hit the trunk lid of a Ford car to show the durability of soy plastic. We can do that today with soy plastic made from soybeans.
Carver and Ford's creative partnership is echoed in what the Ford Motor Company calls the U-Car. Built in 2003, this concept car's interior is made entirely from an eco-friendly, recyclable polyester with soy-based seats and tailgate. While the Ford Motor Company carries on Carver's belief in the soybean's potential, so do scientists at Iowa State University, Carver's alma mater. But while Carver worked primarily with the oil from the soybean, they focused on soy flour. They've used the flour to develop a breakthrough formula for producing a new variety of durable plastic. Soybean farmers around the country are well aware of Carver's early research and the potential of using soybeans in commercial products.
Washington Carver discovered years ago that there was this multitude of products that could come out of our natural bioproducts. Soy has been called the miracle bean because it is so usable in so many different ways. And Carver recognized that, and the soybean farmers of the United States have carried it that one step further.
The newspaper industry embraced the soybean in 1987, when soy ink was first used in the printing process. Today, more than 3,000 papers across the country use color inks made from soybeans. From the St. Louis Post-Dispatch to the LA Times, publishers are finding that the soy-based products are just as practical as their petroleum-based counterparts. Construction engineers are discovering the soybean's value as well. A recent example of their work is the new roof atop the Shedd Aquarium in Chicago.
It's non-toxic. It's 100% waterproof. The application of it is very simple, very easy to do, and it will save us energy by reducing our heating and cooling costs in the building.
In the 1940s, the soybean's greatest champion had gained world renown as a scientific pioneer. But George Washington Carver remained a simple man. Although he was the head of the Agricultural College at Tuskegee, when he went out to the farms to teach, people often mistook him for a hired hand. But his trademark rumpled suit was never without some sort of fresh flower or weed in the lapel, a symbol of his love for nature.
Carver was a curious character. He cared nothing for his outer appearance. When he was going on speaking tours, if somebody said he ought to dress better, he would say, well, if they want a suit of clothes, I'll send them the clothes. If they want the information, I'll go.
Carver never married and professed to be completely fulfilled by his work.
Another thing he said about a wife was, what woman would want a husband forever dropping soil specimens all over her parlor? And how could I explain that I had to go out every morning at 4 a.m. to talk to flowers?
For nearly half a century, Carver lived alone in his room at Tuskegee. In his free time, he enjoyed crocheting, one of the handicrafts he learned back in Diamond Grove, Missouri, when he was a child. Continuing another legacy from his childhood, Carver devised a way to make various pigments and paint from the soil he found in the Alabama countryside. He combined the clay soil with equal amounts of sulfuric and hydrochloric acids and bits of scrap iron. Carver then boiled the mixture until the iron dissolved. The result was a dry paste that could be combined with oil to make paint.
At that time, it was absolutely phenomenal. And to see the pure royal blues that he could extract from Alabama clay just is mind-boggling.
To achieve his brilliant blue color, Carver added a compound of potassium ferricyanide and nitric acid.
See, the genius of Carver was that he wouldn't just do that and then write a paper and then get an award for doing that. He would then go out to people's farms and take these buckets of paint and stay overnight with the family, helping to paint and beautify their homes.
He was a chemist, a botanist, a biologist, an agronomist, and this consummate researcher. George Washington Carver was a man way before his time. Can you imagine what he could have done with a computer?
Carver was a fearless trailblazer, a driving force in discovering ways to use natural resources to benefit mankind. Another area of research he pioneered is just now starting to give the oil industry a run for its money. Inventor Thomas Edison once offered Carver a six-figure annual salary to work for him. Carver declined and stayed at Tuskegee Institute, where he earned $1,500 per year. George Washington Carver Tech will return on Modern Marvels. We now return to George Washington Carver Tech on Modern Marvels. Today, American farmers are harvesting approximately 3 billion bushels of soybeans per year. 80% of the crop George Washington Carver championed is used for protein and food products for both human and animal consumption. The other 20% is used to produce soy oil, which, as Carver demonstrated, can be used for a variety of purposes. One of the fastest growing applications for the oil is in biodiesel technology.
Biodiesel is a diesel fuel replacement that's made from any vegetable oil or animal fat. And the way that it's made is you take a vegetable oil and you react it with an alcohol like ethanol or methanol, and that reaction causes the glycerin to separate from the oil, and the resulting chemical compound is biodiesel, and it acts very chemically similar to diesel fuel in a diesel engine, except that it is 10 times less toxic than table salt and biodegrades as fast as sugar.
The roots of biodiesel fuel go back to the 1930s, when Carver and Henry Ford recognized the need to find alternative fuels. With the economy facing a depression, they tried to turn the tide by applying more agricultural products to growing industrial markets, like plastics and rubber.
Mr. Carver and Mr. Ford saw that the depletion of fossil fuels was inevitable. They looked for the use of plants like soybeans to be that fuel of the future.
Carver and Ford believed that vegetable oils could be used to fuel internal combustion engines, and they were not alone in that conviction.
Dr. Rudolf Diesel was a German scientist who invented the first diesel engine. It's a compression ignition technology that's much more fuel efficient. And he ran that first engine on peanut oil. And he was a scientist along with George Washington Carver and Henry Ford, all scientists who had a vision for sustainability and renewable energy through agriculture.
The high cost of agricultural energy sources compared to petroleum-based fuel held the technology back. Fossil fuels were abundant and cheap, but today that gap is closing.
In the last 3 years, for example, the price of biodiesel has come down dramatically, while the price of diesel fuel has almost doubled.
In just 5 years, the biodiesel industry has gone from research and development to the open road. It has been tested over 50 million miles in every type of diesel engine.
Now there are more than 500 commercial fleets using various blends of biodiesel, including all four major branches of the military, federal government fleets, municipal fleets.
George Washington Carver was not only a pioneer in the biodiesel field, He also took some of the first steps into the area of genetic engineering. Carver created hybrids with the flowers and plants in his laboratory by painstakingly crossing two specimens and waiting patiently for the results.
And it can take years of crossing and back-crossing and selecting for the better quality.
Today, a new generation of research scientists has assembled at Tuskegee University to conduct experiments in all facets of biotechnology. One objective of the research is to find ways to transplant genes from one organism into another.
We kind of carrying on the legacy of Carver's in terms of crop improvement, of nutritional quality or biological resistant quality for better human health and nutrition.
Tuskegee scientists are currently working on a gene that will increase the amount of amino acid in sweet potatoes. More amino acid translates to a higher protein level in the crop.
So we have improved the quality of sweet potato by fivefold, making sweet potato as good as soybean protein. So that's a big legacy of Carver that we're carrying also.
Carver's extensive experiments with the sweet potato focused on its nutritional properties. He knew that planting sweet potatoes would replenish the soil with important nutrients. He urged farmers to make it a part of their crop rotation plan and taught his students how to plant the potato and care for it on campus. This way they'd be able to teach others how to cultivate this iron and protein-rich food. In his laboratory experiments, he succeeded in creating more than 100 products from the sweet potato, including fabric dyes and flour. During World War I, wheat shortages in the United States raised demand for Carver's sweet potato flour. It was used to make bread to feed American soldiers and their allies. Carver's innovative work with the sweet potato was among his many success stories that inspire today's Tuskegee researchers. Here, the march of science is measured by his example.
I think he'll be happy. We work in his building there, and I think sometimes we think like we see him walking around and say, yes, go on, you're doing a good job.
George Washington Carver's vision knew no bounds, and the long shadow of his legacy is about to go stratospheric. In 1925, Carver was granted a patent for making face cream, primarily from peanuts. George Washington Carver Tech will return on Modern Marvels, here on the History Channel.
Everyone deserves to live a little, don't they?
Vegas Vixen on Breaking Vegas, tonight.
We now return to George Washington Carver Tech on Modern Marvels. The innovative work of George Washington Carver has had a far-reaching impact on our world today. And now his influence can even be felt in outer space. For the past 18 years, NASA engineers have been working with Tuskegee University scientists to find efficient ways to grow food in space.
There will be lunar bases, Mars bases, sometime way out in the future. And even for long-term space flights, people have to eat.
For humans and long-term space missions, it's costing approximately about $10,000 per pound to lift a pound of payload. And if you're going to space, it is be very expensive to take soil with you since you want to grow plants.
Today, when the space station food supply is low, a new shipment is sent via an unmanned spacecraft. If the craft misses its mark, serious problems can occur. The hungry crew could be forced to return to Earth. Or worse, a multi-million dollar mission would have to be aborted. So plans are underway to grow enough food for the space station to be self-sufficient. The Tuskegee scientists began their work with two of George Washington Carver's favorite plants. The peanut and the sweet potato.
Our job was to take Carver's two commodities he was most famous for and figure out how to grow them, first of all, with no soil. That was our first job. Now, isn't that a setup for Carver? I mean, wouldn't that be right down his alley?
The Department of Agricultural Sciences at Tuskegee pursued a unique hydroponics-based growing system called nutrient film technique. It requires no soil and relies only on water and a mixture of growing agents.
And the nutrient solution flows continuously over the roots as the plants grow.
The tiny roots form a fibrous carpet or soil-less bed for the plants. After 2 or 3 weeks, the potato starts to change color and bulk up. As part of the NASA program, the university also built growth chambers to produce basil and carrots in the same way.
We can control how much light they get, what time they get it, the temperature. And not only just one temperature, we can actually ramp the temperature up just like nature does it.
The Tuskegee scientists tested their growing system for several years. When they were sure that it would work in a space environment, they shared their findings with NASA.
And when the NASA folks came from Kennedy Space Center to see it, they could not believe it, but there it was. So that's why I'm saying it took some really, I would say Carverites are brilliant young faculty and students who just stayed at it.
Today, a new crop of Carvers in training is sprouting up in San Antonio, Texas.
If it would have had real shallow roots way up here and that's it, you think you'd be able to tap way down and get some water?
The Carver Academy is dedicated to keeping the spirit of George Washington Carver fresh in the minds of today's youth. The school was founded by former NBA superstar David Robinson.
It started more because I grew up kind of with a teacher's heart and always wanted to teach, always loved teaching, and since I became a basketball player, teaching was pretty much out of the question, but I've always loved inspiring and stirring the heart.
The school emphasizes the same hands-on learning techniques that Carver practiced in his career. And the teachers also try to instill in the children a curiosity about the world around them.
You know, nature speaks to us every hour if you would just listen. We're so tech-oriented. We know everybody wants to play with the latest gadgets and see what, you know, science is coming up with. Well, the most incredible things we have are right there in nature. They're right in front of our faces. They're the plants that grow right in front of us. And the kids have access to the most remarkable resources every single day.
It's overflowing.
The Carver Academy is perhaps the best tribute to the scientist who was constantly honored during his lifetime. He accepted every award with his signature humility.
I am not sure that I am worthy of this splendid citation, but I wish to say also that I thank you from the depths of my heart.
He just refused to give himself credit for any of this. He gives the credit to God.
On January 5th, 1943, at the age of 78, Carver died of natural causes in his room at Tuskegee Institute. 6 months later, President Franklin Roosevelt established the George Washington Carver National Monument in Diamond, Missouri. It includes the 210-acre farm Carver explored as an orphaned slave child.
Yes, he was born into slavery, and yes, he had great obstacles to overcome. But every obstacle that he overcame led him one step closer to becoming the great man that he was.
He just made those steps. He just kept walking. And he walked right into history and right into our lives every day.
George Washington Carver's work has been impacting and enhancing our culture for more than a century. For the next generation, determined to further his legacy, the challenge is daunting.
We are standing on the shoulders of giants, and Carver is one of those giants before us, you know, and we are to we don't have to reinvent the wheel. What we do is we stand on what that foundation that's already been laid is, and that's a great foundation. Carver's built some blocks for us, but you know, we have to continue and take that tradition further.
Education is the key to unlock the golden door of freedom. George Washington Carver. I love to think of nature as an unlimited broadcasting station through which God speaks to us every hour if we will only tune in. George Washington Carver. Now, George was born of slave parents on July 12, 1864 in Diamond Grove, Missouri. As a sickly child at birth, he would remain frail for most of his childhood. Now, because he was so small, George was not suited for work in the fields, but he did have a great interest in plants and wanted to learn more about them. On the farm, George fell in love with plants and Mother Nature. He had his own little garden in the nearby woods where he would actually talk to the plants. He soon earned the nickname, the Plant Doctor, and was producing his own medicines right on the farm. Now, George was denied admission to Highland University because of his race, but he did get accepted into Simpson College in Indianola, Iowa in 1890. He became well respected for his artistic talent. Carver's interests, however, lay more in science, and he transferred from Simpson to Iowa Agricultural College. He distinguished himself so much that upon graduation in 1894, he was offered a position on the school's faculty and was the first black person to have that honor. Carver was allowed great freedom in working in agriculture and botany in the university's greenhouses. In 1896, he received his master's degree in agriculture and in 1897 discovered two funguses that would be named after him. And later, that year, Booker T. Washington, founder of the Tuskegee Institute, convinced Carver to come south and serve as the school's director of agriculture. At Tuskegee, Carver developed his crop rotation method, which alternated things like peanuts and peas with cotton, which depletes soil of its nutrients. And following Carver's lead, southern farmers soon began planting peanuts one year and cotton the next. While many of the peanuts were used to feed livestock, large surpluses quickly developed. The farmers were ecstatic with the tremendous quality of cotton and tobacco they grew later, but quickly grew angry because the amount of peanuts they harvested were too plentiful and began to rot in overflowing warehouses. Within a week, Carver had experimented with and devised dozens of uses for the peanut, including milk and cheese. And in later years, he would produce more than 300 products that could be developed from the lowly peanut, including ink, facial cream, shampoo, and soap. Suddenly, the same farmers who cursed him now found a new industry had sprung up that could use their surplus peanuts. Next, Carver looked at ways of utilizing the sweet potato and was able to develop more than 115 products from it, including flour, starch, and synthetic rubber. Carver did not stop with these discoveries. From the inexpensive pecan, he developed more than 75 products. From discarded corn stalks, dozens of uses, and from common clays, he created dyes and paints. Suddenly, Carver's fame grew and grew until he was invited to speak before the United States Congress and was consulted by titans of industry and invention. Henry Ford, head of the Ford Motor Company, invited Carver to his Dearborn, Michigan plant, where the two devised a way to use goldenrod, a plant weed, to create synthetic rubber. Thomas Edison, the great inventor, was so enthusiastic about that he asked Carver to move to Orange Grove, New Jersey, to work at the Edison Laboratories at an annual salary of $100,000 per year and state-of-the-art facilities. However, George declined the generous offer, wanting to continue on at Tuskegee. He continued constantly working with peanuts, sweet potatoes, and pecans, trying to produce new products. He developed more than 300 products from the peanut, 175 from the sweet potato, and 60 from the pecan. He extracted blue, purple, and red pigments from the clay soil of Alabama. He researched the manufacture of synthetic marble from green wood shavings, rope from cornstalk fibers, and veneers from the palmetto root. During World War I, he worked to replace the textile dyes that were being imported from Europe. He ended up producing and replacing over 500 different shades. In 1927, he invented a process for producing paints and stains from soybeans. George Washington Carver was an incredible human being. He had such a connection with nature, and he attributes his success to God and to nature. Now, George Washington Carver is a great example of creativity and connection to a higher power. With that connection, we can all create anything we choose. Now, it is important to remember the incredible inventions and innovations of Mr. George Washington Carver when it comes time for us to get creative and manifest that which we want for ourselves and the people around us. Now, George Washington Carver took his knowledge and used it to help Southern farmers get out of poverty and start to live a sustainable life. Now, I'd like to close with another quote from George Washington Carver. Since new developments are the products of a creative mind, we must therefore stimulate and encourage that type of mind in every way possible. Now, if you're looking for some creative ideas that will stimulate your mind, then you might want to check out theideaactivators.com. There, you'll find some really creative information that just might show you what you've been looking for when it comes to creativity and innovation.
All right, that's enough PSA. George Washington Carver. Mother named Mary, raised up by father named Moses, as an orphan, as a slave, saved the South, tried to help black farmers get the best out of the crops. One of the greatest Americans that I will not let you forget. George Washington Carver. Yeah, that was good. I don't know what to say after that. It looks like Robin Kelly has won. And it looks like the establishment has not won in the Republican Party. Let's see what they're going to do, y'all. Let's see if the Republican Party are going to back this nominee. Because he's going to take it to her. It's going to be very interesting. It's too close to call right now. I'll let everybody know tomorrow who is in the Republican category. But it looks like Robin Kelly has won the Democratic nomination. So we're going to see how that be. I would like to thank you all for listening to me tonight. Let me know what y'all think about that George Washington Carver clip. Yeah, I'm going to leave Jesse alone for the rest of this week and manifest on the great works of all the African-Americans that I've been highlighting over this last month. I got two more days. We're going to have Ron Carter on tomorrow, and we're going to discuss this election, Chicago, or whatever my man want to talk about. Ron Carter, one of the great minds here in Chicago that does not get enough credit. All right, everybody. It's What's Going On Wednesday tomorrow with Ron Carter, and let's find out what's going on. So like I say every night at this night, I'm sorry for your callers that call and I get to you, blame it on Ebony. Good night, everybody, and may your God be with you. And we will not forget you, George Washington Carver, because you were an angel sent here from heaven. But to those politicians, take them out, Stevie.